morning. You're listening to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm your host, Emily Nelson, and today I have two guests from the Freshwater Society, which is an organization based in St. Paul with a mission to promote the conservation, protection, and restoration of all freshwater resources. I'll let both guests introduce themselves.
My name's Leslie Yedka, and I'm a program manager here at the Freshwater Society. And I've been here for about 4 months.
So I'm Jen Cater. I'm also a program manager at Freshwater Society. I've been here for about a year.
Well, thank you both so much for speaking with me today. We're going to be talking about winter salt use and ways that we can keep ourselves safe from the ice while minimizing the impacts of chloride on the environment, with an emphasis on water quality. Would you mind starting off by giving us a summary of salt use and what its impacts are?
Road salts, which can be various different types of chlorides, is used in the winter because of its ability to melt snow and ice, which then can help us keep our roads safe, our streets and parking lots and sidewalks safe from slips and falls or cars sliding. So it's used as that public safety piece. The problem is that it's often overused, incorrectly used, used at the wrong time, and in other ways that result in an accumulation of the salt getting into our local water bodies, so our lakes, our rivers, our streams, which has some serious environmental impacts for those water bodies, but also has other impacts as far as our drinking water quality, impacts to infrastructure like our roads, and even some damage to things like floors in people's houses, issues with pets. So there's all these different pieces that come with it that people don't think about when they're first thinking about trying to, you know, just stay safe in the wintertime. So a lot of the issue that comes with road salt is a result of that perception of the need for safety without recognition of how, in a way, this overemphasis on safety is resulting in overapplication that is damaging all these other different pieces of our environment.
You mentioned impacts to drinking water quality. Along the North Shore, many people rely on Lake Superior for their drinking water, but there are a number of people who have wells. Can you talk more about the impacts of road salt use on groundwater?
I think one of the things that makes it difficult to talk about the impacts of chloride on groundwater is just this idea of these two bodies of water being connected. People always think about there's, you know, one body of water for groundwater that's underground and it's in these big lakes, and then there's another one that's surface water and that just sits on top in you know, basins. But the truth of the matter is these two different sets of water are integrated and they interact with each other. They flow from one into the other consistently. And so the issue with chlorides then that enter into our surface water is that it eventually, because chloride moves really well through water, it can get into our groundwater systems. And especially in Minnesota, where 75% of our population relies on groundwater wells and supplies for their drinking water, that's a lot of salt that can get to the people who are living in the state and using that water for drinking, using that water for washing things, which that salt is corrosive. So there's another issue there as far as some damage that comes with it. But especially as you're looking at people who have the need for a low salt diet, whether they have hypertension or other issues that require them to limit their salt intake, the federal standard for what is considered safe is 250 milligrams in a liter. That's a lot of salt that's in a single liter of water. And if you're just drinking the water, and you're thinking that that's good for you and that's safe for you, but it has that high level of salt, that can be a problem for people who need to be limiting their salt intakes.
Do you know whether that level of salt in the water would register with our sense of taste as being salty?
I don't know about at that level, but I do know that when they talk about some of the issues with chlorides, they say that, you know, some people do taste salt in their water when it's exceeding the standard. So I don't know about at the standard itself, but if you're drinking water that tastes salty, you're not going to be very inclined to drink.
So I think salt water is about 1,200 milligrams per liter.
Okay.
I mean, that's actual salt water. I looked it up once. It's like 12 or 1,500 milligrams per liter. So 250, I mean, it seems like it's not nearly as much, but it's, you know, at that rate, it's pretty salty water. I do not know, and I would imagine it depends on the person on whether you can actually taste that or not. So I think some people are hypersensitive to salt. In fact, I know I am. When we talk about water quality issues and, you know, the pollutants that are getting into our surface waters as well as the groundwater that we use for drinking, really the two pollutants that are of most concern for groundwater are the is chloride and then nitrates, because those are the two pollutants that can actually travel through soil. It doesn't get bound up by soil. It doesn't get taken up by plants and the microbial community in soil, so it actually breaks through any of that organic material in the soil and actually can then get into our groundwaters. And not only do we often drink the groundwater through by using drawing it up in groundwater wells, but that groundwater is often the form, maintains base flow in a lot of our creeks and streams. And so if that water has chlorides in it, you'll see that it's moving into our surface water streams and creeks, and it's actually contributing chloride to those surface waters.
What kind of effect does chloride have on aquatic life, including both plants and animals?
So one of the biggest impacts that chloride has on our surface waters is it creates this heavier water that sits down at the bottom of the lake or of the wetland or anything else. And that reduces, by making this heavier water, it reduces the ability of the lake to turn over or mix. This can result in it being cooler down at the bottom. It can also result in there being less oxygen down at the bottom. So clearly these two pieces will be a substantial issues as far as habitat, the ability of animals to survive in water that has less oxygen. And so there's that one piece of it being cooler. But conversely, then, if you've got a part of the water that's cooler, you have another part of the water that, again, because it's not mixing, is getting warmer. So when you have that issue, you have new plants that are going to be able to be in that space. You've got issues with warmer water being more supportive of bacteria outbreaks or algal blooms and other things that we don't really like when we look at our water bodies. And so having salt, having it mix into this whole issue that we already are facing naturally, it just exacerbates it and makes it more likely to take place. Mm-hmm. And this can have some serious consequences both for your ability to personally enjoy the water body, as well as the ability of minnows, fish, plants to be able to survive, issues with, you know, dogs and other pets getting into water that has these issues going on as well.
And I'll just add to that that, you know, if you look at the amount of chlorides that are building up in our freshwater systems, it's been steadily increasing over time since we started using salt for our roadways. And so that's very well documented. And if that trend continues, we're going to get to the point where we have, salty, almost saline conditions in our waters. And if you think about our aquatic invertebrates and our plants and our fisheries, they did not evolve to live in these high salt environments. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not anywhere near the ocean. And there's some natural contribution from our underlying geology and our soils to salt, but not at the rate that we're seeing that's accumulating from road salt use. So you know, the impacts on, I don't know if we have a lot of research to say exactly what impacts will be to our aquatic environments, but we do know that what we have here did not evolve to live in those kinds of conditions. So we will eventually see changes if we don't reduce the amount of salt that's getting into our systems.
How about the effects of salt on the home environment?
So some of the impacts of using salt in our home sidewalks and our driveways, when you're putting salt down and people are walking on it, pets are walking on it, it gets tracked around, obviously, into your house potentially. It can sort of burn the bottom of your dog's or cat's paws. Your cat probably isn't walking on it, maybe, but your dog probably is. Also, when it gets into turf grass areas or planting beds, that high salt content eventually, mm-hmm. when it works its way into the soil, can scald the turf areas, and it can also kill off plants. You'll often see spruce trees and pine trees that are scalded from the salt spray from when roads get plowed. So it can impact your garden beds and your turf area. So it's good to reduce the amount of salt. And that does potentially can work its way down into a nearby storm drain or a water body. So it's just a good practice all around to reduce the amount of salt you're using as much as possible.
I understand that salt can also have an impact on the roads themselves.
Especially because if you look at the corrosive impacts of chloride, chloride can deteriorate your concrete and sidewalks and cause damages on bridges and parking garage structures and all these other pieces. And even just kind of getting back to that idea about tracking stuff in, you're going to be damaging the floors of your businesses and of your homes with the excess salt that's coming in. So it's causing a ton of damage in terms of like what's built in on the ground, but it's also causing issues with being corrosive for your vehicles and damaging things like brake linings and just going after your bumper and anywhere where you might have rust, etc. So it really can be incredibly problematic, not just for our natural environment, but for our built environments and the things that we depend on to get around. So I think an important piece of the conversation is just recognizing how the salt moves from where the trucks drop it on our street into our local water bodies. Anywhere where you have a curb and gutter system and you have these pipes that are collecting water that's running across the streets and running into these pipes, that water flows directly to a nearby lake, river, stream, wetland, and dumps into it completely untreated. So anything that's coming off of the streets and coming off of our other hard surfaces like rooftops, sidewalks, driveways, parking lots, all of that gets dumped directly into those water bodies as is. So all the salt that comes with it, all the pollutants that come with it, even things like leaves and grass clippings that are natural but are supposed to be breaking down on our landscape before they get really into the water bodies, these all create additional issues. So in wintertime, when salt melts the snow and ice, the water is going to move somewhere. And when it moves into our storm sewers, it ends up getting into our lakes and streams. Same thing at the end of the season. When you've got that first rainfall, any of the excess salt or sand or anything else that you're using to manage snow and ice will flow directly to those water bodies as well. So you see massive spikes in the amount of chloride coming in after you've got that first rainfall in the springtime, just from what's left on the landscape.
So once chloride is present in our lakes, streams, or groundwater, is there a way that we can remove it?
Naturally, there isn't a way for the salt to be taken up, absorbed, dissipated, or anything else. So once the salt gets into our water bodies, it stays. It's there until you do something like an expensive reverse osmosis treatment, which is not something that your average individual, let alone your average city or even larger regions, are going to be interested in doing unless it's a last resort opportunity. Once it's there, it's there. And the thing that makes it more difficult is we often talk about this idea of what is that safe standard for salt in our water bodies, but the problem is it accumulates. So if we're thinking just about that standard, we're not thinking about the fact that since we can't take it out, it just adds up over time. So anything excess that we're putting down on the ground contributes to that higher level of chlorides in our water bodies.
It's a little depressing to think that something we rely on so heavily as road salt is causing impacts that can't be undone.
We know the impacts that salt has. We know what to do to reduce salt. We just have to have the will to do it and mm-hmm. the education and the political will to do it. So there's a solution, and it's fairly easy.
And that's actually what makes it, instead of being, you know, a depressing topic because we're talking about all these different impacts, is there's a lot of opportunity to make these changes. There's a lot of agency that we all have to be able to make a beneficial impact on our water bodies just by reducing the amounts that we're putting down on the ground, which again has benefits for us too that we'll see right away as well. Yeah. So there's both these short-term and long-term benefits, a lot of low-hanging fruit, which makes this actually kind of an exciting topic to talk about because we can do something about it.
Well, I would say, as with most many environmental issues that we have, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So actually making strides to reduce chloride now and the impacts of chlorides is much easier and less expensive than actually going in and mitigating and removing chlorides, which is nearly impossible without having reverse osmosis play a part in that, which is very expensive. So it really behooves us to actually take strides in incorporating best practices and reducing that salt use before it becomes a problem in many of our surface and groundwater areas.
All right, well, I'd like to remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWH LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and today I'm talking with Jen Cater and Leslie Etka from the Freshwater Society, and we're talking about winter salt use and its impacts on the environment. Jen and Leslie, now I'd like to move on to ways that we as individuals can reduce our salt use. What would be your recommendations?
Well, one thing I've heard repeated over and over is shovel soon and shovel often. So when it first starts snowing, you know, make sure that you're out shoveling. It takes a little bit of, you know, arm work to do it, but it pays off in the end because if you can keep the snow from compacting on your sidewalks and on your driveway, then that ice won't form, and so you won't have that slippery situation. So get out early, shovel early, and keep shoveling, and you don't really need to use any salt. But there are other types of chloride-based desalters or de-icers that can be used. I'm not sure that we really know the impacts of all of them. I mean, there's magnesium chloride, there's obviously sodium chloride, which we've been talking about, but they all have chlorides. Mm-hmm. And then also using the least amount required to get the job done is another sort of best practice that homeowners can do. So you don't need to be covering your sidewalk with salt or de-icer. You just need enough to sort of break up that ice bond with your sidewalk.
Do you know how much salt is recommended per unit of area?
The way that I think is really easy and useful to remember it is if you think about one standard coffee cup, just 12 ounces. So in between your 8-ounce and your 16-ounce when you go to the coffee shop. But one 12-ounce coffee cup is enough to cover roughly the size of your standard parking space in a parking lot. So that also can be about 60 to 70 feet of a sidewalk. So just one cup, so that's really not that much at all. And you can see people that are dumping out that much without even walking a pace or two. So it really is about making sure that you do shovel right away, get out there and shovel, get it clear all the way down to the pavement, break the broom out and sweep up the last of it so that that's not melting and creating ice in the areas where you've missed it, and then make sure you're spreading it out and having that ability to use the least amount as possible. If you do put too much salt down, you'll know it because you'll still see that it's out there. Go back and sweep that up because you can still use that salt. That's still usable at a future time, so you're saving a resource for yourself while also removing the excess that's not going to do anyone any good sitting on the sidewalk after the rest of the snow and ice has been melted. So bring that back inside. If you have a spill, sweep that up and bring that back inside. You can reuse this over and over. And just while we're talking about sweeping stuff up, I want to mention the idea about sand as a way to be able to improve traction. Sand can be used after it's too cold to apply salts. There is a point where it doesn't make sense to be applying any sort of road salt, whether it's sodium chloride, calcium chloride, magnesium chloride. There's a point where they all stop working, and that's where sand can be useful just to improve traction. But there's a problem with sand washing into our water bodies as well, so you want to get back out and sweep that up. The other thing that you see is a salt-sand mix, which is also problematic. There's this idea that it's going to save you time and energy because they're both there at the same time, but at best, you're always going to be half right or half wrong. So it ends up resulting in an over-application of both of these. And once they're mixed, it's not going to be really easy to separate them. And so you can't just sweep it up and reuse it for the best time because they're mixed again, and you'll remain at least half right or half wrong the entire time you're using that.
Salt use is clearly not just an individual issue. Our communities are responsible for applying salt to our roadways. Can you touch on some things that communities are doing to address the negative impacts of chloride on our environment?
I would say that over the past 10 years or so, as we've come to understand the impacts of chloride and salt from chloride into getting into our waterways, communities have realized that they can reduce their amount of use by using more enhanced technology to keep salt or reduce the ice on the roads and sort of meet the needs of a community for safe streets, but also reducing that salt use. So you'll probably, you can recognize that a lot of communities used to use sand and then they kind of went to salt because salt seemed to be much more effective in reducing ice buildup on roads. But communities are starting to use new technologies such as wet salt, and actually brine, which is a water-salt combination, and actually pre-wet streets. So what they found is that they can reduce salt use by actually spraying streets with that salt solution before it snows and keep that ice binding with the roadway. And so that actually has greatly reduced the use of salt. They also realized that the temperature of the road has a big impact on how much salt it takes to actually reduce the ice bond with the road. So by using road temperature sensors on salt trucks, they can actually much more accurately distribute salt and thereby reducing their salt use. So that's just some examples of what communities are starting to do. For instance, in the Twin Cities area, the community of Minnetonka has greatly reduced by over half their amount of salt use on their roads because of some of these new technologies and research that's come out on showing how to reduce that salt use.
And there are a lot of really great resources for local communities that want to explore how they can incorporate all these new technologies and these new best practices. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has a salt training that they have available for both the road, the folks who are taking care of the roads, as well as folks who are specifically working on sidewalks and parking lots. So there's a whole training you can go through where it debunks a lot of myths around this, as well as demonstrates the opportunity that's available for municipalities, for counties, for whoever is doing the application to adjust their practices. And ultimately, like Leslie just said, there was one community that reduced their salt use by 50%. That's a huge cost savings. So even though there's that upfront investment into the actual equipment and technology to retrofit trucks or get new application options available, that ultimately saves the community a lot of money in terms of salt, as well as when you look at the other environmental impacts, reduces the need to address some of those other pieces as well.
And I think to add on to some of the best practices that communities use, another important piece is education, because from the public's perspective, you can probably imagine we have that expectation that we can use the roads even during snowstorms or after snowstorms if we need to get to schools or to the store. And so if you talk to public works staff from a lot of communities, they'll say one of the biggest issues is getting the public to realize that they can, you know, do what it takes to remove snow, but sometimes it just takes time. And they have to plow early and plow often to really reduce that snow and ice. And by doing that, they can also reduce their use of salt. So that public expectation is a really big component of communities choosing to reduce the amount of salt that they use on their roadways.
Right. Like, don't drive 55 in a 55 speed limit zone when it's just snowed or it is snowing. You have to give it that time to be safe.
I attended a training about a month ago on groundwater, and one of the presenters talked about the reality that some of the areas with the highest use of road salt are industrial and business areas. And this is because businesses and workplaces are, of course, concerned for public safety, but also because they're concerned about lawsuits should someone fall on their property, as well as because of public pressure. They may receive complaints of negligence if people don't see salt on the ground.
That's a big part of it. I mean, cities and public works staff usually are responsible for clearing roads for the roadways, but private businesses are responsible for making sure their storefronts are clear, for walking traffic and sidewalks, and even, you know, school campuses, churches, wherever you have people parking and walking. Oftentimes you'll see businesses or places like that that are covered in salt. They're just white with salt. And I think a big reason for that is because it's the perception that they're actually doing something to reduce salt, thereby reducing any risk of, you know, slip and falls and injuries, even though research shows that even reducing the amount of salt to just what is needed to keep that ice from forming, there's no increased risk of slip and falls. And so I know there's been some work done on the out east where they've actually showed that you can reduce the amount of salt and still be okay with regard to, you know, possible litigation.
Right. And just getting back to that piece about being able to see these sidewalks and parking lots that are just white with salt or whatever color it is that they're using, depending on which chemical they're working with. If you can see it, it's too much. Because the point of this is to be able to melt the snow and the ice. And so the appropriate amount is exactly what's needed to melt that amount that's on the ground. So if you're seeing anything that's left on the sidewalk, that's all excess, which is really scary when you start thinking about how little salt is needed to permanently pollute water. It's just one teaspoon, that one tiny small amount, just one teaspoon, permanently pollutes 5 gallons of water, which when you look at those sidewalks, you look at those parking lots, and you can see just how much is on the ground. So that's a lot of water that's being polluted. So the other way to think about it, too, is for each teaspoon that you're not putting down in excess, that's an additional 5 gallons of water that you're protecting, which gets back into that balance of safety and water quality. And then just to the point on what's happening out east, you have New Hampshire has this limited liability bill that they were able to bring forward that was removing or reducing the liability of businesses that were using best practices for salt application. Because even when we're talking to businesses here, I've been in conversation where I'll have a business owner look at me and say, that's great, and I understand that we need to reduce our salt application, but if I'm following best management practices, if I'm only putting down exactly what's needed and people don't see the salt, they come in and they yell at me because they're thinking that I'm not keeping them safe, I'm not keeping their neighbors safe, I'm not keeping their patrons safe. And so there's this huge misunderstanding, and that's where some of those myths come in, of what does safe sidewalk look like. So there's a lot of opportunity just by protecting our business owners that want to be doing right by the environment and want to be doing right by their own pocketbook as well. But there's this fear of litigation that is preventing them from doing the actions and following the behaviors that they want to follow.
Well, that's about all the time we have today. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for telling the story.
And thank you all for tuning in. I would like to announce an upcoming event. Lake County and Cook County Soil and Water Conservation Districts are hosting a gathering to discuss water quality priorities for the North Shore of Lake Superior. The gathering will be held on Wednesday, November 16th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Two Harbors Community Center, which is at 417 South Avenue in Two Harbors. Dinner will be included, and RSVPs are appreciated but are definitely not required. More information can be found on Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District's website, that is www.lakecountyswcd.org, or by contacting Dan Schutte at 218-834-8378. Again, that's 218-834-8378. Conservation Corner is produced by Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District with funding from NOAA and the Office of Coastal Management, as well as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. If you have ideas about topics you'd like us to discuss here on Conservation Corner, I will happily welcome your emails and phone calls. My contact information can be found on our website, which is again www.lakecountyswcd.org. Thanks again for tuning in. This is 99.5 FM, KTWH LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.